You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. And on today's show, our studio guest is James DeLarghi, talking about his debut novel, 55. We'll also hear from Mandy Morton, chatting about her book, Beyond the Gravy, the latest in the number 2 Feline Detective Agency series. And we'll also hear from 9-year-old Farah Lucas, who's a finalist in a national short story competition. But first of all, welcome to Bookmark, James.
Thanks very much. Thanks
for having me. Nice to have you here. We'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment. But we'll hear from Farah, who's 9 years old, as I say, and writing very young. And Mandy, who's been a broadcaster and now a writer. Is writing something you've always wanted to do?
Writing is always something that's been sort of around in my life for quite a while, but it took a long time to actually sit down and write a novel. I went out to Australia and I came back and started writing screenplays, and I worked in screenplays for a few years and short films, developing those, but wasn't able to get any of them produced. And then I sort of developed a sort of starting novels. I wasn't as young as Farah was or is, but and then I sort of started writing novels and developed those, and then I managed to get one published in April.
And here you are, you're a writer. Is it what you thought it would be?
Yeah, well, it's obviously when you write for a number of years and you're just looking at a computer screen and printed off pages that you're editing yourself, then it seems strange to hold an actual physical book of yours in your hand. But you have a number of sort of, you obviously give interviews like this that you're, as a writer, you're not used to sort of sitting and talking about what you're actually writing. It's all usually confined to your own skull, but. I'm slowly getting a bit more used to it.
Enjoying it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's fantastic because it's obviously it's what you aim for whenever you start writing. You aim to first of all write the book and then get the book published and then sort of come and talk about the book. So yeah, it's sort of the a dream come true. Yeah.
Well, we will be talking about the book very much in the show, but we'll hear your first choice of music now, which is Sam Stone by John Prine. Why this one?
Well, it's a written song, about a man who's come back from war, and he's now addicted to heroin and morphine. And it's also a song that myself and my brother's kids would sing in the back of the car. We were only, 6 or 7, and we would sing, we wouldn't know the meaning behind the words, obviously. And we'd be singing, there's a hole in daddy's arm where all the money goes, which is obviously about him injecting, him sort of mainlining drugs into himself. So, and we obviously don't understand that. We're all singing this sort of refrain in the back of the car. And it's just, there's just the lyrics. They're so poetic, in the end, the veterans sort of climbing walls with sitting in a chair, which is just, wonderful, sort of tech on, he's drug addled. And my favourite line of all comes from the refrain, which is sweet songs never last too long on broken radios,
very powerful.
Yeah, it's very, very powerful.
Sam Stone came home to his wife and family after serving in the conflict overseas, and the time that he served.
That was Sam Stone by John Prine, the first choice of music on Bookmark today from our studio guest, James DeLarghi. James was born and raised in Ireland, but has lived in South Africa, Australia and Scotland. 55 is his first novel, published earlier this year. It's sold in 20 territories so far and is being made into a film by Zucker Productions in partnership with Prodigy Pictures. Well, that's very exciting, James. Is that really happening? Because often these things are optioned, aren't they? And then you don't hear anything. But is it really happening?
Well, so far I'm not sure. Again, it's been optioned, and they've had it, you know, for, and they were out looking for a identifying a screenwriter for it. So I haven't heard anything recently.
You didn't put yourself forward because, as you say, you've got
Yeah, but I whenever they sort of they didn't ask why I didn't put myself forward, is that they wanted a sort of more established screenwriter to sort of adapt it into screenplay form. So I'm not sure at the minute what the latest is, but obviously I remain hopeful that it does become a film.
I can see why it's been optioned into a film. It's very visual, you know, the atmosphere and the countryside. It's set in Australia, Western Australia.
Yep.
Why did you set it there?
The book itself, visited and lived in, you know, Australia and gone around Australia. West Australia is such a beautiful place. It's you know, it's got, you know, it's the scenery and it's the atmosphere and the sort of the place itself lends itself to the book, you know, and being remote and isolated, and
a small town.
Yeah, it's a small town that's sort of taken over by this sort of hunt for a serial killer.
Yes, tell us about the plot as much as you can. For those who haven't read the book, what the novel's about.
Yeah, at 55, it's a thriller about in West Australia involving search for the truth. Two men enter Sergeant Chandler Jenkins' remote West Australian police station, and they both tell the same story. That they were kidnapped and escaped, becoming the 55th victim of a serial killer. But they claiming that the other one is the serial killer. And so it's down to Sergeant Jenkins to determine which one is telling the truth.
It's a brilliant premise. How did you come up with that?
Again, it was one of those, walking's quite good for coming up with premises. And it was essentially a what if premise. What if two people walked into the police station and told exactly the same story? How would you determine who was telling the truth?
And we're Chandler, really, aren't we? Because we're trying to work out which one is telling the truth.
Yes, and it is written from Chandler's perspective throughout the book. Yeah, and we're trying to work it out while he deals with other issues, as in protecting, you know, the town and dealing with former colleagues who instigate themselves into the investigation.
Yes, he's got this is a kind of subplot of the man who's brought in to lead the investigation was his former partner.
Yes, Mitchell is his former partner. He's gone on to bigger and better things, but it's obviously, this is such a high-profile case, he comes back to lead the investigation, and putting Chandler sort of into a
demotes him effectively, doesn't
well,
he?
Well, yeah, sort of takes over and gives him all the menial jobs that he doesn't want to do, really.
And you called it a thriller there.
Yeah.
Is that how you would classify it? Because it's sort of crime thriller.
Oh, yeah, well, yeah, it's obviously anything involving a serial killer that's going to involve crime. But, yeah, so it's an atmospheric sort of crime thriller, I suppose, would be how I would describe it.
And we mentioned Western Australia is set in a fictional town, Willebrook.
Yeah, it's the town Willebrook is sort of an amalgamation of a number of different places that I visited, sort of with the verandas and, you know, islands and sort of it's sort of an amalgamation of a lot of different places that I visit when out there.
Because for crime, location is really key, isn't it?
Yes, and especially for this one, that it's the isolation, it's the fact that there can't be a third party cooperation of which one of the two men are actually telling the truth. So it's down to Chandler and the police to determine who is.
Did you have a map of it in your head?
Yeah, I think I always have a map of the town and the surrounding locale as well. It helps also to develop what the environment looks like, and parts of the book describe what the, you know, parts of the town, sort of the rat runs of how you move through the town, how you move through the town unseen type of thing. So it's always been, I think that's the screenwriting angle coming back, that my writing would be quite visual because I'm used, that's why I sort of started in screenwriting, which is a very visual medium, obviously.
And it's very much Chandler's town as well, isn't it? He calls it his town. So by learning about the town, we learn about him and vice versa.
Yeah, well, Chandler considers himself this, you know, he's effectively the sheriff of the town, you know, it's as well. And he's protective of his townspeople.
It does have a Wild West feel about it.
Yeah.
You know, I know the sheriff is the term that's used there, but it does have that feel.
Yeah, well, Wilbrook itself is a town that was sort of, it had sort of a turn of the 19th century, 20th century town, sort of developed for just through the sort of mineral rush type of thing. So it's a, it does have that sort of feel.
One horse town kind of feel to it.
Yeah, it's laid out that way. And like a lot of towns are, is, you know, wide streets and, you know, and just sort of the becking hot weather as well sort of lends itself to that.
And where did Chandler come from? How did you go about creating him?
Well, Chandler came from he's obviously given him, he's a man who isn't a typical sort of hero in a book where he's not an ambitious, police person. He's just happy. He's dealing with he's a single parent, so he's happy trying to bring up his two kids as best he can, as well as doing this job and sort of dealing with all the sort of petty disputes in town. Nothing too serious. He's happy in town without having, you know, anything major, and then this sort of is thrust upon him.
Yeah, the idea of this normal, sleepy town really being disrupted by a serial killer, that really comes to life there, creating that atmosphere.
Yeah, that was it. That I didn't want a typical sort of go-getter, you know.
With a drink problem.
Yeah.
A vintage car. Yeah, yes, he doesn't have any of those.
No, he has his own issues to do with, his ex-wife and his kids and his, you know, just trying to bring them up as best he can.
Well, we'll talk to you more about 55. Thank you, James. But we'll hear now from Farah Lucas. Farah is 9 years old and from Haslingfield. She entered a 500 words writing competition run by Explore Learning. Over 17,000 other children entered the competition, but Farah was named as one of the top 10, which means her story will compete against the other 9 to decide who becomes overall winner. When I met Farah and her mum, Grace, I started by asking Farah to read me her story.
It all begins on a typical school day. I get out of bed, brush my teeth, put my school uniform on, an ugly vomit green jumper, a neon yellow shirt and a black skirt, and pack my bag containing an e-book, my laptop and, of course, my oxygen mask. Every time I look at it, it makes me shudder. I feel like I'm in the middle of World War II, but I remind myself I'm in 2025. I arrive at school and see that we've been sent to the hall again to top up our oxygen, as the pollution level has just been raised. Yeah, I forgot to mention that. We all have to wear masks in London now when the pollution is bad. First it was only the children with asthma, then all of us. I think back to a few years ago and realise how lucky we all were, but how naive too. I've been documenting all of this on my vlog, My Life in a Mask. At first, no one paid attention. Then some kid from a small village in the north of Scotland posted something about the difference between our lives and it went viral. People started watching my channel in fear of the problem spreading beyond the big cities. While we are topping our oxygen up, the bell goes. The bell of doom, as I call it. The bell that means we can't go outside until further notice. I don't know where I get the idea. It might be the piercing sound of the bell or the grey smoggy colour of the day. But something snaps inside me. I run out of the hall, climb over the school gate into the busy road outside and rip off my mask. People look at me in astonishment. It's against the law not to wear your mask when the alarm is sounding, and no one wants children passing out in public. The government has a reputation to protect. They need to look like they're doing something, and this is their answer. To make us look like robots or aliens. Then it happens. People get out of their cars and begin to take pictures of me on my knees, sitting in the smog in the middle of the road, with my mask swinging in my hand. In a click of a button, they're all over the internet. They say the image is like one of those famous ones now. A man in front of a tank in Tiananmen Square, a starving Ethiopian child, and me, on my knees, on the Marylebone Road in 2025, struggling to breathe. The government couldn't ignore it anymore. Petrol and diesel cars were abolished. For every car that was scrapped, a tree was planted. Masks would never help us change things, but one girl, unable to walk down the street and breathe, did. Here today, 5 years later, I'm sitting in front of my statue, taking a deep breath of fresh air.
Farah, that's brilliant. Remind me how old you are.
I'm 9 years old, nearly 10.
And when you got the assignment, did that story come straight into your head?
Well, I rolled the dice originally, and it kind of just formed. And as I went along, I edited it and came up with like new ideas to improve it. It has changed a lot since I first wrote this story, but in a good way. And I think that it does take a lot of hard work, but it's for the best, so yeah.
And when you say you rolled the dice, do you mean you literally rolled dice?
Oh, on the Explore Learning website, they did a story dice, which helped you form your story. I rolled a tree, which kind of made me think about like nature and our planet and climate change and everything like that. And I also rolled a factory, which made me think a lot about pollution and our planet and how it's damaging the earth. And that's a big part of how the story formed.
And have you written stories before? I guess you write a lot at school.
Yeah, I've written lots of poetry in the past, and I have written two stories, one of which I entered into the 500 words competition. I remember writing one called The Magic Mushroom, which was one of the most vivid memories I've got. And that was kind of how my passion for writing started. And obviously at school as well, narratives and poetry, so yeah.
Do you want to be a writer?
I would like to write some books in my life. I would like to be an activist when I'm older, because I'm very passionate about the things I believe in. But also I would like to like write a lot of books, because I'm also quite interested in philosophy, so I guess I want to write books which I can relate to and I'm passionate about. Probably like non-fiction books.
And 500 words isn't very much, is it?
No.
Did you, what were the main challenges of that?
Oh, well, I started writing off the story, it had 993 words. Oof. So there was a lot of editing to do, but I guess that kind of improved it in a way as well, because it filters it out a lot. It says no more than 500 words, but I'm very precise, I'm a perfectionist, so I wanted to do it like perfect. So I spent a lot of time, and the main challenge was finding the bits to keep in and keep out, and putting new bits in and new bits out. 500 words is like not a lot. You would think, oh, that's a lot of words, but when you write a story, it's really hard. So yeah, that was a big challenge for me.
Because you have to set the scene, and then you've got the middle bit where things happen, then you have to round it up.
Yeah. So I've got to write the story with description. I want to do really well, but obviously with 500 words, that's quite hard, which I guess makes it more of a challenge, but it makes it more impressive when you can achieve it.
What was the main thing you learnt writing this?
My inner me came out. I haven't written in a while any stories, and it kind of just made me feel free and really proud of myself. I don't know, it just made me feel like even more like passionate about the situations going on in the world and everything. If that answers your question.
It does. Well, you should feel proud of yourself. It's a great story. What would it mean to you to get onto the shortlist and then win?
It would mean like the world to me. Obviously the prizes are so amazing, but just getting that far in the competition is amazing, and it makes me feel just really good about myself and my story and everything. And also the prizes are amazing. Meeting Alicia Dixon, going to Disneyland, is just like my dream coming true. If that were to happen, like obviously if I don't win, I will be disappointed, but not too disappointed, because I know that I've done my best and I've tried my best. And obviously everyone needs a chance and everyone should be given the chance. And I still feel so proud of myself for actually even entering the competition.
And your mum's here. Mum Grace, you must be very proud as well.
I'm incredibly proud of Farah. She is an avid reader, and I think that really helps, because she's always inspired to write herself by reading amazing books. You can always find her curled up in the corner of the house reading. Yeah, she's a very, very determined girl. She said to me she's wanted to enter this competition. She found the information in the Week Junior magazine, which she reads, and she brought it to me, and then she just borrowed my computer and went away and wrote it and came back to me, and we talked about it, and then she went away and edited it some more. And she kept reminding me there was a deadline, so she drives it all herself. I think she's a very inspirational girl, and I'm very proud.
It's a very mature story as well.
Yeah, Farah's, I guess, maybe not a typical 9-year-old. She is a very mature girl. And I think sometimes when you're like that, the world is quite overwhelming sometimes. You're very sensitive and you feel things really a lot, which makes sometimes being a child quite tricky. But then you can put it all into your writing and you can explain to people things maybe that they haven't thought about in a different way. She is very mature. And I think that also comes from her reading and her
Shakespeare.
Oh, she loves Shakespeare as well.
You love Shakespeare, wow.
Yeah, I'm a bit of a tragedy girl.
Who's your favourite writer, Farah?
Either Ross Welford or Kieran Millward Hargrave. They're quite modern writers.
What do you like about them?
Just their creativity, and they've got such a vivid imagination. And I don't know, there's a feeling that you get when you're reading their books, which kind of makes it feel like lifelike. It makes you feel like you're in, like the story's coming to life. And I can't really put it into words. It's like this feeling when you get when you're reading. It's just incredible, their writing. I feel so inspired by them.
Well, good luck to you. Good luck to you, Mum. Supporting Farah. Good luck to you, Farah. You've been
Thank
quite
you.
Inspiring yourself. Yes, good luck to Farah Lucas, and you can find out more about that writing competition at explorelearning.co.uk. Listening to that with me on Bookmark was James DeLaghi, here to talk about his debut novel, 55. She's quite inspirational, isn't she, for 9 years old?
Very inspirational. To have that sort of focus as a 9-year-old is very, very admirable. And the story itself was very powerful and atmospheric and relevant as well. So
yeah, she's quite humbling, really.
Yeah.
And she was talking there about editing and plotting the story. How did you plot 55? Did you know at the beginning which one of these two men was telling the truth?
At the start, no. It's and with some books you have an idea of who has sort of committed the crime. But with this one, because they were both, you know, telling the same exact same story, then it could develop naturally as the who was telling who is telling the truth and who isn't. But my writing style would be to outline. I sit down and sort of plan, you know, the book and outline, quite a detailed outline, and then sort of look at that outline and maybe move some things around, see what works best, see what works, you know, for, because there's a number of, obviously, plotting and pacing, and there's a number of different things that you're looking for. And then once I'm happy with the outline, then I would actually write the book itself.
Because the current action is kind of juxtaposed with something that happened in the past between Mitch and Chandler. So we get to know more about their relationship by this incident in the past. Again,
yes.
Did you know about that? Did you write that at the same time or before?
Yeah, they're both written at the same time. I knew that I could, because of the it's describing sort of Mitchell and Chandler's sort of past and how they, you know, were friends and that sort of drifted apart, and now Mitch has come back into his life again, you know, and that sort of combat between the two of them, you know. So yeah, they were both sort of written at the same time, and they are, you know, they play off, you know, how they were in the past and how they are now.
Well, let's see your second choice of music now, which is Jockey Full of Bourbon by Tom Waits. Why this one?
Well, there's with Tom Waits, there's about 100 tracks I could choose. He would be my favourite artist, full stop. And it, there's just, you know, he can, it's from his storytelling and from his sort of, just he can write sort of desperation and character driven songs, to, you know, and then sort of songs that find humour in very dark places. So it's a very good one to write, or it's a very good one to listen to when you're writing as well.
They're all quite dark, these song choices.
Oh, well, yeah, that would be my I don't know. I'm not sure. Well, I'm sure I listened to uplifting music as well. I just, for these are the ones that sort of came to mind. The song I'm going to choose is from an album called Rain Dogs, which is sort of by Narrow Margin, the album that I prefer. And sort of Jockey Full of Bourbon is sort of a tale of murder and treachery, full of lots of wonderful characters, set in sort of a sort of steamy town that's sort of described perfectly. Isn't it?
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
And our studio guest on Bookmark today is James DeLarge, talking about his debut novel, 55, which, as we were discussing, is about a serial killer. Did you have to research serial killers, James?
Yeah, well, I looked up, you know, there's quite a few Australian serial killers, and there's quite a few serial killers throughout the world, but that would be, I'm quite, you know, intrigued by, you know, crime and serial killers, and you know, the reason behind, you know, why somebody might commit, you know, such a crime, you know, what's the backstory, what's, you know...
The psychology.
Yeah. Because it's obviously something that... Well, hopefully myself and yourself won't do. So you have to find out why somebody might be sort of driven to commit such acts.
And in this novel, there's also this supporting cast of characters as well at the police station, his friends as well as his family at home. So that was important to you. It wasn't just focused on Chandler and Mitch, his former partner.
No, because it's obviously everybody, you know, is involved in this search, and everybody has their own role in the story, and, you know... And it's also those characters sort of give you a... There's also characters in town that are described, you know, to give a sort of a whole to the atmosphere as to who would live here and who, you know, and how they go about their daily business and what they do, you know. And it's I do like writing about, you know, an entire town and setting, and sort of trying to make it as, you know, real to the reader as possible.
And it, without giving anything away, it feels poised at the end to move into a second book in the series. Is this the start of a series?
At present, it is not the start of a series. The second book at the minute is going to be a standalone book. That's also going to be set in Western Australia, but a bit further south in an area known as the Great Victoria Desert. And... Well, it's going to be about a detective that comes in to an abandoned town in the Great Victoria Desert to discover why a family who moved out there have gone missing, and discovers that the family and the town itself have secrets that might cause them to disappear.
Excellent. That does sound good. But yeah, we won't be seeing Chandler then for some time.
Well, not at present. He's not going to make a return at present, no.
I'm going to ask you about the title, 55, because that's quite unusual to have a number as a title. Were the agents and the publishers happy with that?
Yeah, I think they were happy with that because it's quite easily translated. there's not a lot of work that has to go into, you know, if, you know, it can read across a number of different languages, you know, and it also stands out very well, you know, on the front of a book, you know, 55. So when you're writing, especially when you're writing a debut novel, you're not really focused on what, you know, what might work well in, you know, for editors and, you know, agents and that. You're just more focused on finishing a book that an editor or agent might, you know, look at and like. So,
well, and it has double meanings as we find out throughout the book. We'll take a slight sidestep now. Do you like cats, James?
I grew up in the countryside and we used to have a few sort of half wild cats that sort of they would come for food occasionally and then disappear for weeks and then come back for food again. So yeah, I'm more a dog person.
Oh, okay. Well,
but cats, I don't mind cats.
Okay. Well, you might still be interested in this. This is an interview now with Mandy Morton. Mandy began her professional life as a musician, firstly with the band Spriggans of Tolgas and then as a solo artist. She then moved into broadcasting, appearing regularly on BBC Radio Cambridgeshire and here on Cambridge 105 Radio. Her first book in the number 2 Feline Detective Agency series was published in 2015, and the latest, the 7th book, Beyond the Gravy, came out earlier this year. They all feature the detective cats Hetty and Tilly. Legendary crime writer P.D. James has described the novels as original and intriguing, a world without people which cat lovers will enter and enjoy. When I met Mandy, I asked her if she ever expected the characters to have such longevity.
Absolutely not. It started with just one book, one idea, and as far as I was concerned, that was going to be it. The strange thing was about it that after I'd written the first book, which, of course, initially I wrote it to raise some money for the Blue Cross Cats Home here in Cambridge, and self-published it and everything, and then a London publisher picked it up and said, well, maybe we could have another one. So now we're on book 7.
So what do you think it is about these characters that is appealing to people?
There are an awful lot of cat lovers out there. There are an awful lot of people that are very, very kind and will adopt rescue animals of all denominations. So I think we are a nation that has a soft heart. We're also a nation that likes to laugh, and we devour crime fiction. So stick all that together and that's what you get.
7 books in, can it go further?
Yes, it is. I mean, for those that have got hold of a copy of the book, they will see that the next book in the series is actually currently in production, as they say. That'll come out next February.
And are the characters changing as you write about them more?
The stock characters will always be the same because I know them very well. I mean, Hetty and Tilly, who are the number 2 feline detective agency, they were cats that my partner and I have known and had and sadly have lost. So it's wonderful to read, rejuvenate them and bring them back to life. And other cats in there we have known very well as well. And to give them sort of semi-human but very cat traits is just an absolute delight, because every cat, as a cat owner knows, is different.
So Beyond the Gravy, what's this one about then?
This is a bit of a supernatural crime fiction, essentially, and it's drawn from, as most of the books are, from some of my experiences as a broadcaster and producer, because you get to sort of work on lots and lots of amazing projects. And one of the characters who's a returnee in Beyond the Gravy is a character called Irene Peggledrip. And I've created this sort of micro town set somewhere in the 70s with a very long high street, which in my mind, whenever I write about it, is Mill Road here in Cambridge, because that's where I spent my bedsitter days. So I've bucketed us all back into the 1970s where there's no DNA, there's no internet, there's none of that nonsense. It's all about solving crime the old-fashioned way, with paw prints as opposed to fingerprints, etc. And Hetty and Tilly just do their very best. And one of the characters that I brought back, the town psychic Irene Peggledrip, is very loosely based on a project that I did with Sally Morgan, the star psychic, the TV star psychic. I spent several months following her around, interviewing her in her home, etc., etc., for a big radio project I was working on. you go in there as a non-believer. I mean, I have to be perfectly honest about that, hand on heart. But spending time with Sally and also learning a little bit more about her, because, of course, she was playing to thousands and thousands of people in these big concert halls with her psychic show. You wonder, how does that transfer into such a big audience? But then being on my own with her in her kitchen, she would suddenly and very occasionally come out with some stunning things about me that nobody could have known. She had the gift, but I'm not necessarily saying that it always performed out well on stage. So for me, it was a comedy. It was also something very, very serious that I had to think long and hard about, because I wasn't sure whether there was another world out there or not. I'm not religious, so I'm a non-believer as far as that's concerned. But there is something about people's spirits that hang around. So I couldn't resist incorporating that into a new book. And also, sadly, a couple of years ago, Nicola and I lost our most recent elderly cat, Molly Bloom. It's glorious because Molly makes her first appearance in the books, and I've given her a cafe in the high street called Bloomers.
It seems to me you have an awful lot of fun with these books, the names alone, but the things you can do, the puns you can use.
I've always loved those wordy type things, and I've always been a bit of a comedian. I mean, even at school, you know, I might not have been great at the practical work and all the other stuff, but I could make people laugh. So now it's an opportunity for me to sort of bring back that sort of humour, and it cheers everybody up. I mean, you know, we're living in weird times at the moment. If you can do a little bit of wordplay or a pun here and there, or make people go, oh, my goodness, that's all good stuff.
It's and the wordplay, are you thinking about that in your everyday world, how you can make that more catty?
Yes, I suppose so. I mean, when I come to writing particular sections in the book, it can get over the top, so I do limit myself to some of the things, because some of the things just could be downright stupid. When I'm reading through, I do take some of them out and think, no, that's a bit too far-fetched. I don't want to use that. So subtlety is there, and satire. I absolutely love satire. So there are a lot of people in these books that some people will recognise, and bringing them back and putting them into the context of the 1970s and the history. And of course, the biggie in this book is the fact that Hetty and Tilly get an opportunity to meet Tilly's all-time favourite crime author, Agatha Crispy. They travel to a holiday home in Devon. Of course, if anyone's been to Greenway, they'll know how amazing it is. I've called it Fur Away in the book, obviously. In fact, there's a running joke about it not being too fur away. But anyway, moving on from that. I just suddenly realised that setting them in the 70s, Agatha Christie would still have been alive. And it came to me in a revelation. I thought, right, this is it. There's going to be a whole chapter where they get to meet her.
And Maddie Pryor said of it, you've created a whole new genre. That's quite true, isn't it? Because these books straddle different kinds of genres.
Yes, they do. And I think it also an awful lot of my life leaks into it. I've been sort of interviewing Maddie for years and years from Steel Eye Span as a musician. Not only that, but in one of the books that I did, The Death of Downton Tabby, I actually turned her into a character in the book called Muddy Fryer. And having watched her on stage for years and years and years, I've just turned her into a cat, and she appears at this Littertray Festival. And I sent her a copy just out of interest to say, sorry, you know, I've done this to you. And she boomed back and said that she was absolutely addicted, and that was that.
Oh, that's so brilliant.
So it was absolutely lovely. The publishers then, of course, very quickly wrote to her and said, is there a comment? So I'm very pleased to see the book comes out with her comment this time.
Has it tempted you to write anything else in a different genre?
Yes. I mean, Nicola and I are working on a crime series which we're probably going to write together. I don't know when we'll actually get time to do it, because time is the problem, because Nicola, of course, lots of people know, is my partner. She writes crime series as well, and she's also got a standalone this year. So it's a matter of us finding the concentrated time to write it. I think it'll probably turn out to be something like the Number 2 Feline Detective Agency, but set in the 40s or 50s with people. We'll see. But we're gathering crimes, you see. We love true crime. And sometimes it's just brilliant to get that. And, I mean, you can't make it up. Some of the true crime is just astonishing. But
yes, I'd love to see the bookshelves in your house. I bet they're a
horrendous.
Bit gory. Yeah, are they?
Some of them.
What are you going to do reading for us
now? I'd love to, yes. As I said, the sort of the essence of Beyond the Gravy is the fact that Irene Peggledrip, the town's psychic cat, has called Hetty and Tilly in, that's the Number 2 Feline Detective Agency, because she is being haunted by seven ghosts who keep visiting. They're disrupting her business. She's no idea who they are. They're not the normal ghosts that she summons up in the house. And so she phones up the number two feline detective agency. She invites them round for tea. It was easy to forget the main purpose of their visit as Hetty and Tilly surveyed the tea trolley. It was bursting with delights, tiny meat paste sandwiches cut into triangles, cheese straws and fruit scones still warm from the oven, a giant bowl of crisps and a Victoria sandwich oozing with cream and jam. Irene settled the cups onto their saucers and poured the milk. She swirled the blue and white teapot before filling the cups and then set it down in the hearth to keep warm should anyone want a refill. "Now, my dears, tuck in. No need to stand on ceremony," she said, plastering a scone with butter. Tilly went straight to the sandwiches and crisps. Hetty did the same but added a pourful of cheese straws to her plate and topped up with more crisps when the willow pattern began to emerge again. The three cats ate in contented silence, with only the occasional bout of lip-smacking and the ponderous tick of a grandfather clock to interrupt. Suddenly, the fire in the grate died, as if an unseen paw had doused it with water. The tea trolley began to shake and then arched its back like a bucking bronco, launching the Victoria sandwich through the air across the library, where it smashed itself against the giant bookshelves. The cream and the jam slid contemptuously to the floor, leaving the sponge to fend for itself next to a set of encyclopedias of the black arts. Hetty choked on a crisp. Tilly abandoned her plate and hid behind Hetty's chair, and even Irene Peggledrip sat bolt upright, her whiskers twitching and her eyes rolling in her head. The clock stopped, and time really did stand still, as a parade of apparitions emerged one by one from the wall of the chimney breast, passing through Hetty, Tilly and Irene to assemble by the bookshelves behind them. Hetty was desperately trying to convince herself that the trick had been a brilliant one, rationalising that if she turned round, there would be nothing to see. But she was wrong. She reached for Tilly's paw and found it, hot, sticky and smeared with meat paste. At least that was normal, she thought, as the extra tea-time guests stood motionless by the shelves. She counted seven. Their faces became animated as she stared at them, the expressions changing in a flickering movements, grimacing and then baring their teeth in a collective silent hiss. Hetty's instinct was to laugh out loud in the hope that they would all quite simply disappear and she could return to her cheese straws as if nothing had happened. But life or death at Peggledrip House was never going to be that simple.
And Beyond the Gravy by Mandy Morton is published by Farrago Books. You can hear Mandy and her partner Nicola Epson also here on Cambridge 105 Radio on the Eclectic Lights Show. You can go to our website cambridge105.co.uk for more details. We've been talking today on Bookmark to James DeLarghi about his debut novel 55, published by Simon & Schuster. James, Mandy mentioning there Agatha Christie. Who's your influences? Are there some people that you go back to in this genre?
Well, from a young age, it would have been the Hardy Boys novels when I grew up.
Oh, yes, remember those, yes.
They're all just mystery, you know, it's all. And then, but the big staple would have been Stephen King, you know, for the, you know, the range of styles and the range of characters that he can create, you know. And, you know, the books are just all just fantastic storytelling. So it would be Stephen King, but there's a lot of people. There's people like Chuck Palahniuk, American, because he's very visceral stories, and Ian Rankin, Val McDermott.
Such a wide genre now, isn't it? So much to choose from.
There's a huge amount of crime authors to choose from. Some people from Colin Bateman. There's a few, really, Jane Harper and Cara Hunter. There's just the list's endless, you know, of people that, you know, sort of influence and, you know, that you know you're sort of the writing that you admire. So,
and you're saying you're writing the second novel. What did you learn from writing the first one? Are you writing this one different in any way?
Yeah, from writing the first novel, it's the first novel that's been published, but I've written a number of other novels. So over the sort of years, I started writing novels about, you know, 8-9 years ago. So over that time, sort of you develop techniques and styles, as in outlining, as I was mentioning earlier. I also don't edit as I go through. I finish the draft and then I edit, because I don't like to go, you know, I don't like to interrupt the progress. So, just sort of, you just develop, you know, techniques and how to, you know, develop characters and how to give them, you know, stories that, you know, work for your book, etc.
So. And what was the route to publication for you? Was it as simple as sending it off to an agent?
It was.
It's never that simple, but
it does take a long time. As I say, I've done a number of other novels as well, and this one then I sent to 4 or 5 agents, and then one came back within 48 hours wanting
Well, that's always a good sign, isn't it?
Yeah, I enjoy, as a writer who sort of sits down all day and looks at the screen, and sort of trying, enthusiastic about their own work, it's good to hear enthusiasm from other people, because then it sort of gives you some sort of.
It can be a very lonely job, can't it? Some sort of feedback is nice.
Yeah, well, it gives you validation that what you're writing makes sense to somebody else apart from yourself. So I got an agent, and then the agent went to, after we'd done some editing on it, she went out then to sort of push it to publishers. So, and that was pushed, and then Simon & Schuster came in and purchased it, and then it was some more editing. There's always editing. And then it was a matter of producing, copies.
Well, good luck with that. I really enjoyed it. One question that we ask all our guests here on Bookmark: what are you reading at the moment?
Well, what I'm reading at the moment, I've literally just finished *The Lost Man* by Jane Harper, and it's set in Australia as well, sort of in remote Queensland, and it's it's about a family trying to sort of come to terms with this tragedy that 3 brothers and one of them died. And sort of coming to terms with that and coming to terms with why he died.
You recommend it?
Very much so. I recommend, I've read The Dry and The Lost Man, or 2 of her 3 books, and both of them are fantastic.
Thank you, James. We'll come back to you in a moment to find out about your last choice of music. This is the last in the current series of Bookmark, but we will be back in September. Our first show in the new series is on September the 14th. Have a great summer. If you do miss us in the meantime, all the old episodes of Bookmark are on the Cambridge 105 website, cambridge105.co.uk, so you can find us there. But we'll sign out now with your last choice of music, James. It's In the House in a Heartbeat by John Murphy. Why this?
It's an instrumental track for a start that I use sort of when I'm sitting down to start to write, because my writing day normally starts at 10 p.m. at night until about 2 a.m.
Oh, really?
In the morning. Yes.
You're an owl.
Well, yes, very much so, where it's, quiet and sort of you've got most of the stuff that you were meant to do during the day out of the way, hopefully. Because I need to write with a clean sort of, mind. And sort of it's a sort of heart sort of pumping number that starts off with a quiet piano before eventually sort of building into this electric guitar crescendo. So